And now, just for you, YK World!
All right, welcome to YK World. I am never going to get tired of hearing that theme music. It is such a delightful way to start things off. Welcome to the show. This is a podcast about the goop between music, art, and technology, told through the lens of YK Records and the Nashville music scene. I mean, that's ostensibly what it's about, but let's be honest. This is the first full episode, so I'm not really locking the show into what it is. That little tagline at the top is a bit of a guide, but this thing is wide open in terms of what we can talk about. Time will tell where this takes us. I'm your host, Mike Leeds, and I want to start things off by giving a big thank you to everyone that reached out after the show announcement to just say anything. As I mentioned on that episode, I've decided that this show isn't going to have any metrics attached to it. I don't know how many downloads per episode there are, and I'm not planning on trying to find out. I will talk about this in more detail later, but the high-level spoiler is that I think metrics on everything have ruined endeavors like this one. You can't just enjoy yourself anymore unless you're juicing the numbers. Not so here at YK World. We're just floating in the ether. So if you listen to this and you have a comment or a question or a spiteful correction, reach out to michael@ykworld.show and let me know. And that's M-I-C-H-A-E-L. Sometimes people spell Michael differently than that, but in this case, M-I-C-H-A-E-L. I'm also on Instagram @records_YK, but all of this is in the show notes. You don't need to like write this down and pay deep attention to these details being shared. So, as this is the debut, inaugural, first official episode, I figured it would be good to discuss how we got here. By that, I mean I'm going to take an opportunity here to be incredibly self-indulgent and give you a little history about little old me. Do I feel uncomfortable dedicating any amount of time to talking about myself, much less a whole episode? Yes, absolutely. But I'm going to grin and bear it and push through because I think an origin story is generally the best kind of story. And overall, I do think it will provide some helpful context as to why this show exists in the first place. And it may even help frame some future episodes. Who knows? So to that end, let's get into it right away. I grew up in a small rural town. No, of course, we're not actually going to tell the story like that, but we like to have fun here. So we just had to throw in a little southern trope. So what we are going to start with is a little history and geography lesson. I currently reside in Nashville, Tennessee, a city with a population estimation of around 700,000 people throughout the county. Nearby are several suburbs that bump that population up to about 2 million. It's not huge by any means, but it's not tiny. However, back in the 1980s, the nearby suburb that I grew up in, Franklin, Tennessee, only had a population of about 12,000, at least according to the Wikipedia and census articles that I found. The house that I grew up in was surrounded by nothing. There were very few neighbors and not a lot of things to do, especially those that you generally associate with kids. What we did have at home were early video game systems and an early personal computer. I was very fortunate that my dad was intrigued by the Atari and the Intellivision systems because I was playing both of those before the Nintendo was ever released. We also had a Tandy 1000 computer, and I was given a lot of free time to tinker on both of those. That tinkering led to discovering bulletin board systems, aka BBS, which, and I cannot believe I'm having to explain this, but back in the day, someone could set up a computer to receive incoming phone calls, and when another computer dialed up and connected, it would serve software over the phone line. That ancient dial-up modem sound that I assume all of my listeners are old enough and familiar enough, that is the handshake between the two computers. I believe the earliest modem that we had was a 2400 baud modem, which really just means it was slow. Listen to how that handshake is. (laughs) What a delightful sound. This is a bit of a tangent, but there is a mesmerizing visualization of those noises that I'll link in the show notes. You've got to watch it. It is beautiful. Just like these undulating waveforms as that is occurring. Really, really gorgeous. Seriously, click through in the show notes. So why is that BBS thing important? Well, as a young kid living in a pretty rural environment, I felt connected to other people thanks to the BBS. I would dial up a bulletin board and play text-based video games that other people were also playing. I would log in and see massive pieces of art drawn with ANSI characters. Those are special symbols on every computer that we all have access to, even today, but are sort of forgotten because we have, like, Photoshop now. I wasn't consciously aware of it, but I was being introduced to the idea that the computer can be used for both art and for connecting with people as much as it could be used for word processing. Tangent number two, if you've never seen any ANSI art, I will also link some of that in the show notes. There is nothing like signing into some stranger's computer and seeing a massive drawing of Satan. Influential, to say the least. So, I'm spending a lot of time on the computer and playing video games, particularly NES, once it's released. I don't think either of those two things are particularly atypical, but I do think that I spent an inordinate amount of time doing both because there wasn't a ton else to do. To be fair to my parents, who may one day listen to this, I was in the Boy Scouts and I did camping and community service, and there were friends in nearby neighborhoods not too far away. I wasn't just sitting alone on the computer all day, but a large chunk of my time was alone and doing video games and computing stuff. Like most kids, music became a defining attribute to many social situations. My first cassette tapes were MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice. Not exactly albums that have stood the test of time, but I was 10. Those were acceptable purchases. I do have an older brother who had already established his taste, and of course, I copied a great deal of that. Shout out to Grady for following the threads of popular bands back to Green River and Mother Love Bone, unheard of gems at the time. He may not have enjoyed my company, but he did provide like a little bit of guidance into some very interesting musical endeavors. We're fine now. Love him to death. I think it's reciprocated as well. So combining all of that with like music subscription services like BMG and Columbia House, I was swimming in releases. I mean, I am of the age that Nirvana's Nevermind and Pearl Jam's 10 both came out while I was in middle school. The most impressionable age you can imagine. If you've never looked at the list of albums released in 1991, do yourself a favor, go click through the show notes and look at the list. It is wild, the list of records that came out in 1991. Leaving middle school, going into high school, music was important because it had been such a defining piece of the entire cultural landscape. Obviously, I couldn't have articulated that at the time, but quote-unquote grunge music was talked about constantly, for better or worse. Throughout high school, I was active in drama club and various band-related activity, not like school band, like playing the French horn or the trumpet, which probably would have been awesome, but like local bands. I'm sure many of you grew up with local high school bands. I'm not saying my experience was rare or atypical, but I am saying that for me, it was massively influential. A few in particular, oh so many years later, stick with me to this day. Caesar's Glass Box. Grungy, but kind of not grungy. It was right on the cusp there. Very advanced songwriting, if you were to ask me. Even now, it seems like way more mature than a bunch of teens should have been writing. There was also a band called Plunge that had a rotating lineup that got better as people kind of moved around. I don't think I would have articulated this at the time, but, you know, they brought the drummer out from behind the kit to become the singer, and it was revelatory. People could do multiple things. Absolutely. absolutely loved Plunge. One of my best friends was in the band as well, so I was a super fan from the start. But I legitimately think the songs are good. I went into the basement this weekend and found the old tape that they released and encoded it for this show because I want to preserve it in some way forever. So if you're a huge Plunge fan and want to hear the entire self-titled full-length album they put out, hit me up, michael@ykworld.show. I will share it. Also around that time was a band called Jezebel, a female-fronted band that, among their own songs, also did a Heavens to Betsy cover of Axeman in 1996. How some 13-year-old girls in rural Tennessee came across early Kill Rock Stars release is beyond me, literally. I had no idea what Heavens to Betsy was, or what Kill Rock Stars was, or what Riot Girl was, or what indie record labels were, any of that. It was all lost on me, but here was a band playing these songs that were very impactful and memorable. I don't think I even realized they were a cover at the time. Crazily enough, Jezebel is the first band that Beth Cameron played in. She would go on to be in Calypso, Fair Verona, Forget Cassettes, and most recently, Black Bra. It is wild that I have been following the musical output of Beth since literally the very beginning. But I have, and I wouldn't have it any other way. Okay, so that's kind of like the formative years. Aside from those local bands, I'm also still very into computers at this point. I'm taking programming classes at school. I am coding early websites via AOL and GeoCities on my own. I think it's safe to say that those experiences shaped my personality pretty profoundly. Everyone has hugely influential events that happened during high school, but please allow me to indulge in two that had a direct impact on my future. I mean, it's a podcast, you're listening, so you're letting me indulge in general. I appreciate it. First, I specifically remember some friends going to an all-ages venue in Franklin called Rocket Town, which still exists. It was originally founded by Christian singer Michael W. Smith and has now changed locations to downtown Nashville. I digress. Some friends went to see a local band where they were wearing animal costumes, they were doing synchronized dance moves, and just generally had a ton of energy on stage. That band was called The Features. Them later, but apparently whatever I looked like in high school was similar enough to bassist Roger Dabbs that someone remarked that we looked alike. So not only was this band incredible to see live in terms of their performance, but I also looked like someone in the band, which no one had ever told me before. I don't know if that's good or bad for Roger, but we did kind of look alike in hindsight. Another very related event that had an outsized impact on me, but is so inconsequential, it's hard to call it an event. I was in the school cafeteria. I saw the drummer for Caesar's Glass Box, a guy named Ian Menard that was a year older than me. He had a personality that was cool, informed, detached, and very intimidating. I think later on he would go to form a band called Detachment Kit. They're fantastic. Anyway, Ian was wearing a shirt that just said self on it. If memory recalls, it was like written on a piece of tape with the lowercase e being larger than the other letters. Someone informed me, possibly Nick Ramsey, shout out Nick Ramsey, possibly Brandon Gregg, not sure. Someone informed me that it was a band t-shirt for a local band from a nearby town called Murfreesboro, Tennessee. That band and their album, Subliminal Plastic Motives, became a very big deal to me. All right. That's as good as anything as a segue into part two, beyond the formative years. Okay, so post high school, I went to college in a smallish town near to Nashville called Murfreesboro, Tennessee. You may have heard John Mulaney make fun of it. If you've not heard that bit, tap through in the show notes and you can hear John Mulaney make fun of Murfreesboro.
In my early 20s, I was doing the show in Murfreesboro, Tennessee. No. Murfreesboro. I'm pronouncing it correctly.
Okay, okay.
I'm not mispronouncing it.
You're not,
That's
no.
That's how it's pronounced.
That's a place.
Murfreesboro. It was, I think it was named by a dying Confederate general as he barely sat up in bed eating mashed potatoes. And his grandson was like, Pappy, you gotta name the town. And he was like, Murfreesboro.
The school I went to, Middle Tennessee State University, a.k.a. MTSU, was not a school I chose for any particular reason beyond proximity to home. That's a shameful truth, but I was not confident enough to go to school far away from home, where I didn't know anybody. I even had a scholarship to some school in Georgia, I think, to learn web development in 1997. No one was teaching web development in 1997, but I was too scared to go and be at a school where I didn't know anyone. So I ended up at MTSU, where lots of people from my high school went. Fortunately for me, Murfreesboro was a hotbed of local music at the time. I was completely ignorant to it, but Billboard magazine ran a cover story in August of 1997, the exact month that I started school, about how Murfreesboro is a quote-unquote emerging music mecca. Turns out the college town was home to a little independent record label called Sponge Bath Records, home to the bands Self and The Features, among others. So, it's 1997 at this point. We're kind of beyond dial-up modems now, and we're into cable modems. But the internet was far from ubiquitous. It was still very early days. There's no Google in 1997. Napster doesn't launch until 1999. The original dot-com bubble wouldn't burst until early 2000. There's definitely no social media. Friendster doesn't even exist until early 2003. MySpace, late 2003. But Sponge Bath Records had a website. It was bare bones, but they had one. The Billboard article even mentions the URL. I'm not sure why I felt compelled to do so, but I reached out to the webmaster, a hilariously dated term now in hindsight, and offered my assistance to help them redesign the site if they wanted to. Miraculously, I got invited to the Sponge Bath offices and what turned out to be an interview. I wish I could remember the specifics of how that conversation with SpongeBath president Rick Williams went down, but somehow I now had a job being the web guy at the coolest record label in town. My experiences at SpongeBath were more informative and transformative than most of my classes at MTSU. I did have a handful of superb professors and classmates, but none of it really stuck with me as much as the lessons of the label. Every single person I interacted with there taught me something new and impactful. Bingham Barnes, a name you might recognize from the band Glossary or Grand Palace Screen Printing, made the first Xeroxed show poster I'd ever seen. I know that sounds ignorant, but I'd never seen a show poster that had been Xeroxed and cut and pasted the way that Bingham did it. Christian Rocco, an ex-DJ from local radio station Thunder 94, that I think may be responsible for me hearing They Might Be Giants the very first time because he played it on Thunder 94 and I happened to hear it. Incredible. Christian was an absolute wellspring of information on how indie and college radio worked. Harrison Rogers, Justin Meyer, and Chris Crawford, they taught me about building those relationships. They taught me how to use Quark Express, how to build a local database with FileMaker Pro. Neil Dietz taught me how street teams work and about how to be a passionate music fan. No one is more of a passionate music fan than Neil Dietz. Probably has more SpongeBath memorabilia than anyone else. Matt Meeks taught me about press coverage, picking and promoting singles, discovering new bands. Rory Daigle taught me about traversing the worlds of indies and majors. Jolie Hummel was the voice of reason and kept the ship running. More lessons than I can articulate. I'm sure I'm forgetting others that work there. Young Ben Young, lots of other interns and people my age came through, and they all brought me something that just soaked right in. Which is non-ironic, given that the tagline for the record label was soaking in the center of the universe. Sidebar here, the center of the universe, soaking in the center of the universe being the tagline for Sponge Bath Records, that was because Murfreesboro, Tennessee contains the geographic center of Tennessee, and there was a market there, just like a convenience store, and it was called Davis Market. And the urban legend was, if you went into Davis Market, you would always be drawn back to Murfreesboro because it was the center of the universe. later on, it would come to pass that you could urinate on the geographic center of Tennessee, and it would break the curse. Quite a thing that Murfreesboro, Tennessee had going for it. I digress. I have a billion thoughts about Sponge Bath Records. It is a story absolutely worth telling on its own. It's wild that it was founded in 1993, and by 2001, it was essentially finished. If memory serves correctly, I would have been there from like 1997-ish to 2001-ish, maybe 98 to 2000. It's crazy to think about what short of a time frame that was and how influential it was and how big it was in the Murfreesboro music scene. And just so short-lived, and how few releases there were. I've compiled the list. I'm telling you, I'm getting away from myself. This is something that I really want YK World to investigate in future episodes, is thinking about this story of Sponge Bath. Maybe there is a mini-series in there that we can do. If anyone wants to help out with this, hit me up, michael@ykworld.show. But there's a great story there. And a lot of it's already been told, but it could be told again. Okay. Other than everyone that I worked with, I also met plenty of band members. Count Bass D was a large presence around the office. The aforementioned Justin Myers, the drummer for Fluid Ounces, he was around. The original webmaster of the Sponge Bath site, unbeknownst to me, literally had no idea who I was emailing at the time, that was Brian Rogers, the guitarist for Fluid Ounces and later the guitarist for Self. I owe him a huge debt for taking that original email. I also met Mac Burris, bass player and Self, an all-around fascinating character. He did the theme song for the show and the music beds underneath it. I'm rather happy to say we struck a chord that has lasted quite some time. I'd like to say that I became friends with everyone that was in Self and everyone that was in the features as well, the two bands that drove me towards Sponge Bath in the first place, but I was too intimidated by them. I absolutely revered them. I collected as many B-sides and bootlegs as I could. I mean, that would come in handy later, but I was a super fan that just happened to also work for them. I came to feel that way about everybody on the label. I was friendly with various members of the bands, Fluid Ounces, the Katies, you know, everyone that was involved with the label. They were all very kind to me, but I always felt very intimidated by everyone. That's kind of a sidebar, not really all that relevant, but I was just a kid. I didn't run a lot of meetings at Sponge Bath, but I do specifically recall bringing everyone into an office one day to talk to them about a new technology that everyone needed to be aware of, MP3s. This technology would allow the entire Sponge Bath discography to fit on a single CDR. I even demonstrated this to the rest of the staff by encoding every official release into MP3 and putting it on a disc. It was very showy. More so, it was very important to note that these files could be put on the website and downloaded by fans. Maybe that meeting is a false memory or vaguely anachronistic, but that's how I remember it, so I'm sticking to it. Shortly after that introduction, again, I'm not sure if my timeline's perfectly correct, but I think it is, we posted a new Self album consisting entirely of B-sides called Feels Like Breakin' Shit. The 17-track album was released over a course of many weeks and highly discussed on the Sponge Bath message boards.
If I was mummified, buried underground, I'd be a millionaire. I was petrified, my body turned to stone. I'd be afraid to walk home, call it good luck.
The message boards, I forgot. In 1998, it was very common to run your own message board, and Sponge Bath had a very lively one. I don't recall most of the folks on there, but I did meet one Brian Bruckman, a.k.a. Subanev, a portmanteau of Subliminal Inevitable. That was a huge Self fan living in New York that also ended up being a huge Forget Cassettes fan and released an EP on YK Records from his band Mount Sharp years and years later, and now runs Totally Real Records, a label I can't recommend enough. I mean, I met this person in 1998 and have kept up with them the entire time and loved their output throughout that duration. It's wild. I also met Chris Mixell, aka MP3 Man 99, absolute gem of a person living in Austin, Texas that I've been friends with for 20, 30 years. This is like tangent 4 or 5, but at the time, it was also common to have an experimental website of sorts. Like, outside of Sponge Bath, I was still very much into building things for the web. So I started posting art explorations and just sort of like artistic endeavors on the web for my own personal website. And my own personal website was based off of my early AOL username, uni.com. kind of a nonsense word, but it actually has a legitimate meaning that I refuse to tell anyone. So if you know what the meaning of uni is, consider yourself in the inner circle. Uni.com morphed from being like an art exploration website into being just a blog, served as a way to share random weird art and technology stuff. I actually still post to it pretty regularly, 24 years later. Sites like Instagram and Reddit have largely replaced blogs, but back in the day, I think uni was pretty regularly enjoyed. Anyway, that's important to add into this story, but feels like a sidebar at the moment. My time at SpongeBath was likely the most influential part of my time in Murfreesboro. I think about it a lot, maybe too much. I mean, I currently own spongebathrecords.com, and it has like a little website up there, and I fully have intentions of putting something more meaningful up there one day, but I just keep thinking about it. Anyway, I digress. There was a lot happening outside of the SpongeBath office as well that was noteworthy. That Billboard article had cited Murfreesboro as the next Seattle, which was wrong, and SpongeBath as the next Sub Pop, which was wrong, but there was a very flourishing music scene in Murfreesboro. Bands like Serotonin blew my tiny little mind with their fusion of emo and hardcore and math rock. Early tracks from the southern-tinged rock of Glossary, which was not in my wheelhouse at the time, but showed me how a band could become exponentially greater with time. And if you go back and you listen to these songs now, they crushed it. They nailed it. I just wasn't there at the time. And some friends from high school, a few members of Caesar's Glass Box actually, had started a band with members of another defunct local band called Harmonium, and that new band was called Airline. And it was a very densely layered, very immersive bit of work that I was a huge fan of. Oh, stop the car, 'cause Airline wouldn't officially release anything until 2003, but the seeds were planted in the early 2000s. I departed SpongeBath largely because I had formed a partnership with fellow MTSU student Daniel Box to offer web design services. We called this outing Somatic Labs and built up a strong portfolio of work in a pretty short amount of time. I was able to bring SpongeBath into that portfolio, and Daniel had a long list of clients that he'd done illustration design and development work for. I'm kind of glossing over this part of my college experience because a lot of it was really just sitting behind a computer, eating Sonic and nerding out between rounds of Tony Hawk. Why did I leave SpongeBath is a very good question, but it got kind of shaky there, and a lot of people were really unhappy, and it seemed like the writing was kind of on the wall. There was new management, and there was an attempt to sort of run things differently than it had been run, and I'm sure a lot of that was driven by being more financially sound, and quite frankly, was happening way above my pay grade. I was running the website, I was posting MP3s and sort of communicating with fans, but things were changing in the office that I was just really not privy to, and it didn't seem great. So it was a very hard decision, but I did decide that it was time to move along and investigate something else. This partnership with Daniel just happened to come at just the right time. That said, still have extremely positive feelings about my time at SpongeBath. But my partnership with Daniel was huge. Daniel made contact with a company in California that he respected and heard back from a guy named Kurt Noble that offered up some work that was too small for his company but absolutely enormous for two college kids. One of the very first jobs he brought in was the official website for the band Goldfinger. I'm not a huge fan of ska or whatever it was that Goldfinger was making, but doing a website for a band that was part of the popular zeitgeist was pretty huge. After a year of working as Somatic Labs, plus Kurt Noble, we merged companies and became K&I, Kurt Noble Incorporated. Daniel and I graduated from MTSU and departed Murfreesboro, both moving to Nashville and finding an office space with T1 internet speeds. If the phrase T1 internet speeds doesn't send a thrill down your back, you were not working exclusively on the internet in 2001. So I'm going to gloss over a huge chunk of time now because it's largely a lot of late nights working on the internet. But Daniel and I, along with Kurt Noble, Kate Hogg, Arlo Jamrog, Eric Kruger, and a handful of others whose names escape me, made a ton of websites. We did the Now That's What I Call Music series from like volume 4 to volume 20. I specifically remember Arlo making Boz Skaggs' website. I worked on Yanni's website. We did Marines.com. Yes, the official Marines website. I built that at one point in time. We did TacoBell.com. It had like rotating sauce packets in space. We built the official HD DVD website, NERD's website, Lenny Kravitz. It's an unbelievably long list of projects, and it was a huge learning experience being dunked into the deep end of design and code. Daniel is a brilliant designer and pushed me to write better code, making sure to pay attention to the little stuff. Arlo and Eric were always better programmers than I was, but taught me so much. Kurt and Kate ran the business with insights I don't even know about, but hopefully I was picking up along the way. All that's happening in the early 2000s. I'm just in it all the time, writing code and making websites and generally being excited about the internet, but also spending some time offline with the local music scene. Beth Cameron had formed a new band around that era called Forget Cassettes. She called up her old Jezebel bandmate, Sarah Jones, to assist with some band photos and a press kit, and they needed a website. The details are actually a little fuzzy now, but if I recall, Sarah was working at a one-hour Photoshop and printed up the band photos, and then I built out a flash website that looked like rooms of a house. I think it was inspired by the lamps the band used to play with on stage. But that collaboration led to more collaborations, particularly with the band Airline. Sarah and I started taking on projects under the name Skyamore and created limited edition packaging for Airline's debut record. It was hand sewn and stamped. It was an absolute monster amount of work, Sarah doing a great deal of it, particularly with the sewing. But from that, we learned how to screen print and made posters and shirts for Forget Cassettes and for other local bands that we loved, like Apollo Up. That collaboration fizzled, probably mid-2000s, but I learned so much with each undertaking. The appeal of short-run packaging. How to do all the things for silk screening. The biggest takeaway was the direct collaboration on working with artists. SpongeBath had taught me a lot, but it was somewhat disconnected experience working on behalf of the bands. These latest projects were alongside the band, which felt very different. There was also zero budget for what we were doing, which made a nice DIY difference in a good way. Over the next few years, I continued to dabble in various weird projects. In 2003, I started an online beard growing contest where a bunch of strangers uploaded photos of their beard growth every day. And yes, it was as weird as it sounds, but I met a ton of wonderfully creative people through that. I did that again in 2005, renaming it Whiskerino, and again in 2007 and 2009. Each time it like doubled in size, eventually hitting around 500 active members. Kind of got to be overwhelming, but it was a real blast to build it and to participate in it and to have this giant community of creativity. While I was immersed in those shenanigans, I was always going to local shows and keeping up with local happenings, somewhat through a website called Nashville Zine. Nashville Zine served as a hub for concert listings, local music news, various music reviews, and sometimes even saucy rumors and gossip. It wasn't entirely Nashville-focused, but it was largely Nashville-focused and certainly intended for a niche audience. The creator, a man named Todd A., said,
"The idea of the site was that the rock scene could be better covered by those playing in bands and going to shows than the writers of the mainstream media, many of whom didn't even live in our state."
That site actually ran from 2004 to 2006, and in 2006, it closed, and it left a bit of a vacuum for a small but very activated part of the local music scene. In the wake of that shutdown, local musician and filmmaker Doug Lehman started a website called We Own This Town. The intent was to provide much of the same coverage, but also add in some multimedia with a newfangled thing called podcasts. In fact, the first episode of the We Own This Town podcast was published by Doug in September of 2005, just a few months after Apple had even announced support of the format for iTunes. Starting in March 2006, We Own This Town was regularly publishing news and calendar updates. By April, I had reached out to Doug and asked if I could help contribute, which he obliged. He may actually regret that now, but I have published thousands of items to the site and several hundred podcast episodes in the last 19 years, all in service of trying to support the local music scene. That is not a humble brag. That is a flat-out brag. I am proud of that. In August of that same year, 2006, the Nashville Alt Weekly, The Nashville Scene, started an anonymous blog called The Nashville Cream to fill much of that same void that We Own This Town was aimed at trying to fill from Nashville Zine. They have a lot more authors and a lot more resources, and honestly, the Cream got a lot more eyeballs, and still does. But it didn't really feel like a competition, at least not to me. More people being aware of the local music scene just felt like a good thing all around. And that era of Nashville local music was bonkers. Releases from Hot Pipes, Lone Official, How Became the Bomb, Hands Down Eugene, Glossary, Forget Cassettes, Apollo Up. Bands that you might not know at all, but if you were vaguely familiar with the scene at that time, all of those names stand out to you, and they're incredible releases. I believe at that time I was also slipped a disc of demos for a soundtrack to an in-progress movie called Make Out with a Violence. Both that soundtrack and that movie were eventually released years later and still worth seeking out. I think the soundtrack is impossible to find these days, but I'll see if I can poke some folks to change that. I'll let you know on a future episode. It's very good. One of the bands during this era was called Kindercastle. Live, they were a massive setup, probably like 10 people in the band, three string players, horns, guitar, drums, keys. Sometimes they sounded like ELO, sometimes they sounded like an experimental electronic band, and sometimes they sounded like the two fused together. It was a trip. As luck would have it, my web design job ended up getting an office in an area of town called Hillsborough Village. We were directly across the street from a coffee shop called Fido, where, unbeknownst to me, an absurd amount of creative people worked. Dicey Wildman, who would go on to co-found the Defy Film Festival, worked there. Dylan Smith, guitarist for the band Faster's Faster, Fetching Pails, and another mega band that I shall not name, also worked there. Cammie Bergen, who would go on to do a ton of illustration work for Please Vote Nashville and just a lot of fine art in itself, also worked there. There's a long list of people that worked there. That's just three. But it was kind of bonkers how many creative people worked there. I mean, I guess that's normal for a coffee shop, but it was really, in hindsight, it's very impressive. One of the two primary members of Kindercastle also worked there, Ross Warner. Given that I was a full-on coffee fiend at the time, I would see Ross two or three times a day. A friendship ensued, and I would tell him how much I enjoyed his band Kindercastle, and then one day he told me that he had some other music that he'd been working on that didn't fit with Kindercastle, and he wasn't sure what to do with it. He gave me a CDR of 15 songs labeled Uncle Skeleton, which I believe is a Simpsons reference. The music was far more electronic-based than the Kindercastle stuff, but still supplemented with strings and had a vibe that was undeniable. Sometimes upbeat and joyous, sometimes very melancholy, but always really immersive and entrancing, at least to me. This was 2008-ish. I was very interested in taking my local music scene participation further. I was actively posting news, reviews, and now podcast episodes over on We Own This Town. I was helping bands like How It Became the Bomb with their album art and websites, but those felt like assistive roles. With this music from Ross, maybe I could start a label and do really short runs of physical media that kind of called back to the work that I had done with Airline, and gave bands a solid web presence like I had done at SpongeBath. I asked Ross if I could put out the music under a new label I was starting, YK Records, named for my blog, uni.com. Looking back at blog posts from that time, I said,
While I'm not interested in running a full-fledged record label, I am intrigued by the idea of getting music out to the masses that otherwise would not be heard.
It's an interesting quote, actually, looking back, because I don't know exactly what I meant in terms of a full-fledged record label. Do I want to have an A&R guy and a marketing department and all of that? No, I don't think I could handle that, and I don't have the resources for that. But if YK grew into that naturally, I think I'd be open to it, so maybe I am into running a full-fledged record label. Anyway, that's another sidebar for another time. The debut Uncle Skeleton record, entitled Poncho Chumley, was released March 10th, 2009. It was available as a free download or a limited edition CD with artwork provided by Ross's brother, Jason Severs. Hilariously, Jack White's label, Third Man Records, based here in Nashville, was officially founded on March 11th, 2009. There must have been something in the air around that time. The second release from the label happened in July of 2009, and it's been active regularly for the last 15 years, 2025 being our 16th year. Some years have been lighter than others, but there's always been something on the docket to be shared. We went from short-run CDs to vinyl to tapes to all sorts of formats. We even did a couple lathe cuts, and there's even a flexi in the future. Sometimes it's been pretty daunting, and there have been some hard lessons to learn along the way, but overall, I'm quite proud of it and the body of work it has created. With that, I'm going to stop this self-indulgent story for now. There's a large gap of time between 2009 and 2025, but I would prefer to fill that time in by talking about the specific releases individually. Maybe I'll do a future episode where I self-indulge once again and just call it the YK Records years, but I do think now is a pretty natural time to wrap it up and say that's how we got to here. That's how we got to YK Records. When I started this episode, I figured I'd do my best to keep it quick, but it's actually been pretty fun to take a deep dive into some of these memories. Hopefully none of the music I included results in the episode being banned from Spotify, but that is entirely possible. If you're hearing this on Spotify, congratulations to me. It did not get banned. But if you're not hearing this on Spotify, that's probably why. Something got flagged by a content ID system, and Spotify doesn't know what to do with that, so it just blocks the episode. Anyway, that's just another reason to stop using Spotify. More of that in a future episode. If you were like a part of my quote-unquote story and you were not mentioned at all in all of that stuff that I just said, I very much apologize. Tons of people along the way, I apologize if your name was not called out. Hit me up, michael@ykworld.show, and say, hey, you forgot me. I cannot believe you forgot me. Guilt is a huge motivating factor for me, and I will mention you in a future episode deeply apologetically. It's going to be great. It'd be great to hear from you. It really would. Whoever you are that I've forgotten and overlooked and will feel future shame for, reach out and say something. Thank you all so much for listening and indulging me. If you've made it this far, I really, really appreciate it. Our theme music and the music beds, they're provided by Mac Burris, a friend of nearly 30 years. How is that possible, Mac? Hit him up at Mac Burris on Instagram or find the link in our show notes. Find lots of things in our show notes. You can visit the site at ykworld.show. Be sure to drop me a line at michael@ykworld.show if you have questions or feedback or simply just want to say anything to me. I don't know really the best way to wrap this up except to say I can't believe I wrote like a little biography of myself and then forced you all to listen to it. If you made it this far, I really, really appreciate it. And I think this might blossom into some more projects. Like, I encoded all of this music from Plunge, and I found 4 CDs worth of Caesar's Glass Box, and there's a bunch of old Jezebel VHS recordings. There's open Pandora's box by having this podcast, and I thank you for listening to it. I'll talk at you soon.
Bye!